Insights on the Middle East with author and academic Avi Yorish.
Hello, Avi Yorish. How are you?
I am great. Always happy to be on the show.
Oh. Yeah, no pressure, no pressure. Did you hear that seven minute introduction there, Avi?
He's done a lot
of that. No Nobel Prize in my future. Come on, Kathy, you got to cut that out.
I believe it. And one day you're going to, you know what? Do you know the story about Einstein and his wife, his first wife?
Tell us.
No, do tell.
So he wanted a divorce because he wanted to marry his cousin. Okay.
Okay.
This is a true story.
All right.
True story. And he said to her, look, if you grant me a divorce, it's just a matter of time until I win the Nobel Prize for Science. When I do, you will get all that money. And based on that and her belief in him, they actually, yeah, she gave him the divorce. And he gave her the money when he won the prize.
Man of his word.
So, Avi Yorish.
One day. Hopefully no divorces in my future.
No, but hopefully
a little bit of money.
And the Nobel Prize.
Avi, I want to take us back to Iran. 3 weeks ago when I was here, we started our first chat about sanctions, the effect of sanctions, why sanctions, et cetera, et cetera. I missed last week. This week is the week I would like to follow up on the ethnic makeup of Iran, because I think most people would be quite surprised to find out that it is not the monolithic, homogeneous society that perhaps one expects it to be.
Quite the opposite. I mean, really, Iran is a very, very diverse country. I would even say extraordinarily diverse. The vast majority of its population are Shiites, but we do have Sunnis, we have Jews, we have Christians of every stripe and every variety. We have Baluchis, we have Arabic speakers, we have a number of Turkic languages that are spoken on the outskirts of the country. It is extraordinarily diverse.
Avi, why I asked that question is I watched a particular Israeli author giving a chat about this particular issue, and he was saying the effect of the sanctions on the schisms within the society are going to be what's going to undo Iran.
You know, look, I will say my former mentor and friend Uri Lublani, who was one of Israel's last ambassadors to Iran, would always put it as follows. The whole point of sanctions is, think of it in terms of clocks. You have two clocks side by side. The whole point of sanctions is to speed up the regime change clock and slow down the pursuit of the bomb, the ability to pursue a nuclear bomb. And that therein lies really the $69,000 question. Are sanctions effective? Are targeted financial sanctions effective? As we talked about 2 weeks ago,
correct,
targeted sanctions really go after individuals, corporations, and financial institutions. I don't know if anyone really, really has a handle on. And it's not because we haven't been doing sanctions for a long time. It's just it's very hard to know what will be the straw that breaks the camel's back. As it turns out, certainly in South Africa, many of your listeners will remember that one of the straws that broke the camel's back on apartheid was correspondent banking, was the ability to bank internationally. Same was true when it came to Iran. The sanctions regime that was put in place really starting in 2005 by the U.S. government. I mean, sanctions really go back all the way to 1979 when the regime changed, but in earnest started in 2004, 2005. When the Iranians finally came to the negotiation table, the first thing they wanted back was their correspondent banking relationships around the world. The Trump administration has put a lot of those sanctions back into place, not in actuality, but verbally. And many, many companies and financial institutions are now very reluctant to do business with Iran.
What I'm trying to get my head around, I suppose, is let's assume the regime of the mullahs falls owing to targeted financial sanctions. What does Iran the day after look like? Is it a process of Iraqification, of complete splintering, and or is it a cohesive whole holding it together?
I don't think anyone has their crystal ball, and no one really knows. And I will say that every intelligence organization around the world no intelligence organization has predicted some of the massive events that have happened in human history. Not the fall of the Berlin Wall, not the Iranian Revolution, not a whole host of, not the Egyptian Revolution that took place in 2011. So the intelligence community really does not know, and I would not sit here and posit and tell you, Simon, the day after, should there be a regime change, we actually know. Look, in Egypt, no one predicted that a more religious regime would come in 2011, and then 2 years later, you had a complete secular individual in the form of Sisi were to come and take over. No one really knows. Ultimately, it is an extraordinarily diverse place. It's anyone's bet whether it would be someone who was more radical or more liberal.
Avi, something else I was very unaware of was the apparently there's no love lost between Arabs and Persians.
Oh, this goes back a very, very long time. And in fact, if you look at the Iran-Iraq war, which lasted all of 8 years, was really along the Arab-Persian lines. It is an insult to call someone in Iran, Persia, an Arab and vice versa. There's no love lost between these two, I would say, ethnic individuals. The few places where it really does, the crossing of the lines really does work well is Iran's relationship with Hezbollah in a place like Lebanon, where they are both Shia and Arab. Ironically, Iran will work with Hamas, which is a Sunni organization in the Gaza Strip, and it will support other Arabs like in Bahrain or in Yemen. But as a general rule, Arabs and Persians are not fans of one another.
Yeah, apparently it went back to some battle in the 600s where they sold them as slaves and naked and so it's just completely fascinating. I knew nothing about any of this.
But it's the same with the Turks and the Arabs, isn't it? You don't ever call a Turk an Arab, right?
Correct. Similarly, I mean, look, the real schism in Islam happened after the Prophet Muhammad passed away, roughly 630, 631. We don't exactly know the date. There were four righteous caliphs. Yeah. Okay. And then the Islam split into really three, but say it's two major sects, Sunni and Shia. And it really was along the lines of who should lead the mantle of Islam, who should be the person who guides the community. And one sect believed it ought to be one person. And then the other sect believed it ought to be a different person based on bloodlines. And today we're seeing that play out. And they really are, they're two common religions, but they are separate. Sunni and Shia, they're both Islam, but they are different strains of Islam, and fundamentally so.
Avi Yorish, thank you for explaining to us how a situation which we are led to believe is so simple and uncomplex is in fact everything but.
So maybe next week we'll talk about the differences between Sunni and Shia Islam, because they are two radically different ideologies and manifest themselves both in governance and in forms of terrorism very, very differently.
I look forward to doing that. Thank you as always, Avi Yorish.
Thank you, Avi.
Same time next week.